Greetings to you, dear listener. My name is Christian Corley. He's James McLean, and you're listening to the Casterbus podcast, occasionally with a K. We haven't chatted for a while. How are you, James?
Yeah, I'm all right. Lying on my sofa, a little bit of light coming through the window, pouring annoyingly at the dust and the buzzing in my ear, which is your voice, like a cat who just wants to be left alone, but knows he's not going to get away being left alone because he's got something to do and he doesn't want to do it, but he'll do it anyway. What are we talking about today, Christian Corley?
I have a slight buzzing in my ear, but that's tinnitus. That's an entirely different thing. Today, we were recalling some weeks ago, I think, some editions of the podcast ago, of people who appeared in Doctor Who were sort of maybe were slightly ill-judged. And I did a bit of brainstorming on this. And there are some inexplicable and bizarre and, frankly, didn't work, it says here, guest appearances throughout the time of Doctor Who. And I think many of them have probably occurred in the sort of post-1981 era, the JNT era and the Russell T Davies era more than any other. I'm not saying that there's none in the other eras, but they seem to be the ones that stand out. But back in the 80s, Doctor Who was very kind of television show non grata at the BBC and got very little publicity, that John Nathan Turner didn't sort of, I don't want to say prostitute himself to achieve, but he really took things to a different level of promotion, didn't he, for the show, and got going all sorts of stars and appropriate and inappropriate and known and unknown as well. There is, for example, the amazing woman who appeared in Silver Nemesis, no one knew who she was, and yet John Nathan Turner sort of promoted her as some sort of well-known actress from well-known of international repute, didn't he?
Oh, she was well-known in the States.
Was she well-known in the States, or did like five more people than normal know her in the States?
I'm pretty sure she was well known. I did look her up a while ago and I can't remember why. And I was like, oh. But your point
was still
Dolores, stands,
it was Dolores so. Gray, wasn't it? And she was more well known for stage work and musicals, I think, than movies, which may be why she was less well known on this side of the pond.
I mean, I take your point at the time. I had no idea who she was as a youngling. And I agree, I don't think many people knew who she was. And the scene was of dubious quality as well. And it did feel like it was a scene you would sandwich someone big into a show almost last minute.
She'd appeared in Gypsy, taken off from Angela Lansbury in 1973. In the West End, and she was also in the UK at around the time of Silver Nemesis. She starred in the London production of Stephen Sondheim's Follies in 1987. So you can kind of see where she may have come into bringing attention to Doctor Who. And I think a lot of it is bringing attention to Doctor Who, isn't it? It's to the show, bringing in the big names, big guns, as it were, or six shooters, I don't know. And you know, it's
a lot of it.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, go on.
No,
I was just going to say, I think a lot of it stems from a sort of shift in the 80s in terms of, well, a continuation, but I'm from the 70s, but heavily into the 80s, of the personality, the drop in celebrity, which was becoming quite a big thing in a lot of the, there's a lot more sort of, they were more the magazine shows, but I'm thinking if you'd think of even like Saturday morning television for kids in the 80s, you start, well, back end of the 70s, going into the 80s, where you get the Swap Shop, the Twiz was, the Saturday Superstores, which were always having celebrities drop in, sometimes in character. You have a continuation and maybe an further growth of the sort of Saturday night variety and entertainment shows, which would have drop-ins of various famous people, which would continue on after Doctor Who came to an end in 89. You know, Noel's house party and his was it the Late Late Breakfast show before that, the one that had the tragic. But there's a lot of those. That was kind of in that. That was kind of what BBC television was doing a lot of. And I think you're right. I think, you know, Nathan Turner was tapping into that interest and that way of producing and promoting, because those were things which newspapers would pick up on. And I think he was in a position which was an extremely yummy position, that the Doctor Who was something which was quite quirky. And if you dropped a celebrity name into it, that'd be enough for a newspaper to run something on it. And
Well, I
therefore, as you
wonder.
say, you get the coverage.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading up on Noel Edmonds the other day because for one reason or another, and I was thinking about the not the Late Late Breakfast show so much because I don't really remember that as much, but Noel's house party, and I do wonder whether or not maybe John Nathan Turner kind of was maybe driving that inadvertently or otherwise throughout the sort of the second half of the 80s. Certainly, or maybe with Beryl Reid in Earthshock, maybe more, maybe the entire time. And maybe sort of Noel's House Party and other light entertainment shows or something that kind of picked up on it. I don't know. It started
I think
replicating
it
it.
was. I wonder if there's a lot of sort of a certain amount of networking resources. I mean, the BBC was very much a centralized, you know, London BBC. It was very much a centralized space where there was a lot of flow of talent coming in and out. Maybe that in itself made it sort of almost like a point where you could easily either grab assets or assets would be able to easily get involved in a production because they were kind of familiar with the framework of the institution. So you're sort of tapping into that resources to find unusual guests. And, you know, in a funny way, you can see how that has proliferated in the sense of with, you know, modern day game shows, how they sort of play that same sort of celebrityism quite literally with I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, or more recently with Taskmaster. You have this sort of thing where people are get to a point where Doctor Who is at a point where you are expecting there to be guests and you're wondering who they would be this series. So that sort of coverage, as you say, seemed to really start to energize in the 80s. And I think you're right. I think, well, I think we're both right. And Doctor Who at the BBC was one of those, to my mind, early catalysts. Now, neither of us had any research on this, and I'm sure someone who probably has could turn and go, actually, you'll find this being done in the 60s and the 70s as well, in sort of a more sort of a early form. But from our recollections, I would kind of say that Doctor Who was doing this fairly early on in this tapping into the asset culture, because the asset culture become so much bigger than in the 60s. You know, television was in a growth period. It was not, you know, it was still growing, and the institution was still growing.
There wasn't really a
And the
concept
various,
of, I was going to say, there wasn't really a concept of casting people to bring their fans with them in the 60s and 70s, and probably not so much in the 80s, but maybe a little bit of it as well, which is something that happens now, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, and I wonder whether it's, you know, bringing in fans as well. I sometimes wonder whether it's almost like an ingredient ship of an oddity. So, you know, you get someone who doesn't really fit in the genre, and then you put them in the genre or into the show within that genre, and that is the intrigue. You know, Beryl Reid as a space captain on a spaceship in Doctor Who, with you know that you're following each week. That's a kind of weird curiosity. I mean, obviously Ken Dodd is another very famous one, and I wonder if that's kind of where it is that you don't have to be a fan of Ken Dodd per se, but the idea of Ken Dodd as at some toll port meeting the doctor, and you had, I remember at the time, the ridiculous picture of him and McCoy sort of facing off in a sort of gurn was kind of like, you know, that was how it was being framed. So
It's yeah,
yeah,
this
I think, yeah.
the presentation of
But it's the
these
same like with
things.
Taskmaster, though, isn't it? It's that same thing. You don't have to be a fan of the people on Taskmaster, but it's like, oh, X comedian or star is coming on to it. I'm interested to see how that will work. So it's a mixture of the talent's legacy, but also the framework that they're entering, which is the interest.
I don't watch Taskmaster.
I'm surprised. I think you'd probably enjoy it.
Well, I watched it once and I didn't enjoy it. It felt so scripted that I decided not to watch any more of them. I barely laughed.
That's very odd. I mean, I watched a few with my family a few years ago and I wasn't that engaged. I don't particularly drop into new things with any eagerness. And again, it kind of grated a bit on me. And then I think over lockdown or a little bit after lockdown, I remember watching it and was like, actually, this is actually quite enjoyable. It's, I mean, there are some scripted elements, but there is also a lot in there which isn't. And it's watching for those moments, which is particularly interesting. But anyway, we're deviating off par.
The presentation thing of these of certain people who have come in, as well, because you mentioned the Ken Dodd and Sylvester McCoy bit there, and I was reminded the other day scrolling through Twitter, someone had shared the, it may have been Facebook, but it was probably Twitter, the clips of guest stars of the season of Doctor Who Before Last, Stephen Fry and Lenny Henry, and how they were presented in this sort of darkened room with a sheet behind them. And to be honest with you, I think there's something a little bit, although cheesy and a little bit silly at the time, I think the Ken Dodd Sylvester McCoy one is a little bit more charming than Stephen Fry grinning at the camera and followed by Lenny Henry. I don't like that one at all. It feels slightly sinister as well, as if they've been presented as the people that are going to eat you later on or something.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I remember in the 80s finding it frustrating. I wasn't happy with Ken Dodd being in Doctor Who. It felt to me as if it was almost like a, I don't know, it kind of belittled the value of the programme, the drama of the programme, as if it did, as you say, the Knowles house party vibe. It kind of felt like it was shifting the show, almost like a nod to the show being almost an absurdity that as Knowles house party is, or, you know, as at the time, you'd kind of expect to him to appear on the Ross Abbott show or, you know, one of those sort of, at the time where there was, you know, a plethora of those Saturday night sort of Ross Abbott, before that Kenny Everett, and that sort of thing where a celebrity would drop in a sort of slightly awkward way. And it felt almost like Doctor Who was being pushed a bit in that direction. And I think that was possibly because Ken Dodd himself is quite a, was quite an absurd character.
Well, he was quite Bell a good Reed actor though, wasn't he? He was quite a good actor.
He did fine. But I found it quite hard. I think at the time, I didn't... I think Doctor Who was growing up in a way that I... was growing up in a way which was faster than I was.
Yeah.
In the sense that Delta and the Bannermen I hated at the time because it felt silly, the idea of having a toll port in space.
This one absurd guy,
and the whole trip to the 50s. It just felt silly to me. And again, it frustrated me in Greatest Show in the Galaxy, where you'd have the Adrian Mole, literally the Adrian Mole nerd on his bicycle and his pullover. And as I got older, I sort of kind of saw more of a sophisticatedness to what they're doing to sci-fi at that point, which started to become far more visible in the 90s, where, you know, they kind of worked out that you could have a person in the future wearing a suit and tie because it signified to the audience what they were, and you could just kind of get away with it. There became a sort of far more sort of flexibility in the genre to play with sort of things in a different way, in a way that just kind of challenged how you thought of space and time and futures and past, and we're like, you know, we can do anything. This is our, you know, and we don't have to be wearing silly silver suits to show the future. We'll have someone wearing a woolen pullover because why not? How is that any sillier than someone in spandex? So I didn't quite get that. But yeah, Ken Dodd to me felt really absurd. I didn't like it.
Yeah, that's fair.
I didn't like any of the intrusion of the cast. I didn't like Hale and Pace in Survival. They were promoted as, look, Hale and Pace coming to Survival, as if, hey, look, someone important is coming into this silly show. I didn't like that vibe. But I also felt that they weren't very well directed in that show, that they were very hammy and awkward, and it didn't feel like a very good scene. And could have been the acting, it could have been the way it was directed, could have been the script. It just didn't work. And again, like Ken Dodd, it pulled me out of the moment. The one that did kind of work for me, which generally doesn't, was Richard Pryor's in Paradise Towers.
All right.
I mean, he was very over the top.
I find that more cheesy than and more jarring than the Ken Dodd's one. I think maybe because he was on TV weekly at the time as well, wasn't he, Richard Pryor's?
Right.
So that may be why.
Well, yeah. For many years he was on weekly, wasn't he? It was always something he was in.
Usually ever decreasing circles.
Yeah. But I quite liked his performance in that.
Yeah, I did as well. Actually, I think I should maybe find out. I haven't watched that in years, and I used to remember thinking it was wonderful. So I should maybe venture back in. I've recently been watching the first series of Hello, Hello.
Right.
Which is so silly. I put it on at like 11:45 the other night to fall asleep to, and obviously I didn't fall asleep to it because it was the one with the liquid gelignite in the gin bottle, which accidentally gets fed to the chickens, which then blow up. So yeah. Anyway. So yeah. Richard Pryor's. So go on then, Richard Pryor's. You felt it sat better.
I felt it sat better. I mean, I always quite liked Paradise Towers. The cleaners frustrated me because I could never envisage in my head how they managed to get anyone into their carts with that one arm, or how they caught anyone with that one arm. But I actually thought the story was quite well done, and the sort of the play on bureaucracy with the caretakers, I thought was, you know, pretty good. You know, it was, some would probably say sub Robert Holmes, but it was quite Holmes in its sort of send up of that sort of the idea of I suppose the security guard who believes they run the building, sort of thing, of these yeah. over officious people who are left in charge who would have been at the bottom but now are at the top when they don't really, you know, they don't know how to handle their power. And I kind of liked that. It kind of worked for me. And I liked, you know, you had little windows into the towers, into the people who lived there. And I thought the ending with Pex was quite beautiful as well, even though he was a bit of a silly character. It paid off in the end. It was a good, and I thought, as it was Carignan, was it? I can't remember. What was the name of the, it wasn't Carignan, was it? The beast, the brain at the in the tower, in the cellar when Bryars is taken over, even though it was an overtop performance. I think because it was very all anti-Bryars. You know, Bryars was fairly known for playing quite soft, if slightly grumpy characters.
Yeah.
And he plays quite a hard character there. It worked for me. While Ken Dodd kind of played Ken Dodd. And he did it fine. Yeah, there wasn't any problem with it, but it felt like Ken Dodd in space. Well, this didn't feel like Richard Pryor's, the character that we'd seen in his various sitcoms in space. And I think that's why he worked for me. Well, Beryl Reed, again, felt a bit like Beryl Reed, as I remember her. I mean, she was fine, again. Oh, no, it's not fair, actually. She was quite good as the character.
I think she's really... I think maybe for people of a certain age, i.e. us, who may have remembered her from other shows at the time, it may be... In that context, it's a bit jarring. But in terms of casting someone as a captain who's a bit unusual to be the captain, I think she's absolutely fine. I like her grumpiness and her wanting to get on with it and to cash in. It's a bit like the crew on Robots of Death, only even less functional, I suppose.
I suppose the problem is you've got a two-way thing, haven't you? You bring a celebrity in, so a face that people know, into a part. You take away from that part its ability to be seen purely for the part, because the viewer is constantly renegotiating the fact that they know that face from something else, and it's no longer, and it's doing something that it's not, it's in a space where it shouldn't be. But yet at the same time, by doing that, that role is given an extra focus, which it might not have if it was an unknown. If the captain was done by an unknown character, would they be as memorable as if you didn't have this constant, you know, cognitive thing going, this dissonance in your head watching Beryl Reed? So I suppose it can work in the show's favour to a degree.
And of course, she was a serious actress as well at one point, and she did a bit of comedy and stuff. But and then she kind of ended up doing kind of a lot of children's show appearances, and it's a strange career. Interestingly, she died and was born the same years as John Pertwee. I was looking into why certain people may have appeared, particularly the American people in the 80s. Not so much these days, because you know, things are a lot easier these days. And we established that Dolores Gray had probably been in the UK around the same time. Stubby K, again, someone I'd never heard of, despite seeing how many of his films? Two. And one of them was After. He was in the UK filming Who Framed Roger Rabbit when he was filming Delta and the Bannerman. So that kind of makes sense as well, doesn't it? Take the opportunity, these people in the UK, take the opportunity to, you know, they've got a few days away from filming that, get them into the show, throw a bit of cash at them for a day's shooting. That works, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think, I mean, because you say, I mean, the 80s pretty much almost had it was virtually to a point where as a guest star per episode, per story almost, but so there is a lot to pick at. And yeah, I don't particularly like it. In the same way, I don't particularly like it when Stephen Fry appears. I mean, Stephen Fry is not alien to the genre particularly, so he never really stood out. Lenny Henry was an interesting, who is now a staple in the Lord of the Rings prequel, and is doing a very good job as well.
I think Stephen Fry has a problem of being Stephen Fry, I think, and it's very difficult to get, it seems to be very difficult to get him to be anything other than Stephen Fry when he's not being Stephen Fry. For instance, I think Kingdom did okay, and I think his Oscar Wilde is fine, but a lot of the time he kind of, I mean, this Doctor Who appearance, for instance, it just feels like midway between an episode of A Bit of Fry and Laurie and an episode of Blackadder. It doesn't really. Yeah. Anyone could have been playing that particular part, so it doesn't really feel like he's particularly required there. I'm just looking at Silver Nemesis because, of course, there is the other. There's a couple of other things going on in Silver Nemesis, isn't there? For instance, you've got Anton Differing, who I think died shortly afterwards, and he was a well-known actor, a German character actor who'd done a lot of movies, war movies, in the days and appeared in ITC shows and things like that. And then you've got the surprise appearance of Courtney Pine in the Jazz Pine Quartet.
Yes,
when the Doctor and Ace are relaxing. I have a big soft spot for Silver Nemesis, and it's obviously,
oh, so do I.
That and Remembrance are obviously almost the same story. But I think Silver Nemesis, there's some marvellous, just the production and design of Silver Nemesis, I think works really well, a lot better than probably the script does. I do enjoy it, though. It looks beautiful.
I mean, there's something that always bugs me a bit when people say that. I mean, it's like when I used to, it was like the TV show Millennium, and, you know, in the 90s, they're always saying, you know, the first season, every week, it was pretty much a serial killer story. You know, at the time, the press were like, it's just a serial killer of the week show. Who would want to watch that? You know, and 10 years later, that was entirely pretty much the FX channel. Every show was that. And I kind of feel with Silver Nemesis and Remembrance is that they are very different stories. Yeah, there are sort of folds of similarities in the Doctor playing chess pieces with a major villain. And it's like, but you could almost do that as a TV show. And that would still work if it was every week the Seventh Doctor befuddling it, or it feels like an American drama would do that, you know, because what are most detective shows are, look at Monk, which went on for, you know, what, eight seasons or whatever it was, and nine seasons. That was him sort of every week going to go and solve a crime which he couldn't do because there was some issue of hygiene, or there was something that triggered him in some way which he would have to overcome, and there's nine seasons of that. And you have two episodes, two stories of Doctor Who, which are vaguely similar, and one of them is attacked because it's too similar to the other. And you just think, well, that's television, isn't it? It's the replication of formula. And so I think the problem is that Remembrance was very, very good in the sense that there was nothing really wrong with it all the way through. It was a solid story. Well, Silver Nemesis has some lovely bits in it, but there are some bits which aren't as good. And so it gets kind of knocked down for it. But it's doing loads of different things to Remembrance, and it's doing loads of different things which the New Adventures would do. It was almost like a precursor to the New Adventures in the sense that TARDIS could just go anywhere in that story, And at the time, that was bizarre. The Doctor wants to go back, he will. If he wants to go and land by a hangar, he will. If he wants to go, there was just no issue. And that was kind of new. And as I say, the New Adventures did that all the time, as does the TV series occasionally.
Okay,
And
Nicholas
it felt kind of
Parsons.
fresh.
Yeah, it does. And I
Yeah,
suppose that's a rare
Nicholas
disagreement for
Parsons.
us as well. But let's skip forward to The Curse of Fenric. Nicholas Parsons, who
Are we disagreeing? I thought we were agreeing on that. So
I
I'm
think
going
we
to have to stop you there.
I
Where are we disagreeing on this?
I think I was being a little bit unkind to the Silver Nemesis and Remembrance of the Daleks similarities. I was
Oh,
more
I
bare
see what you
bones in
mean. I
their
see what you mean.
similarities, whereas but you were sort of defending them.
I
But
see. I see. I just kind of thought we would stop there just because, some people might listen to this and think, hey, this is clearly all scripted. They all, this is, they carefully work out every word in advance, clearly. So I just had to dispel that. Clearly, we don't. Clearly. Yeah, sorry. So, yeah, great, great one. Curse of Fenric.
Yes, Nicholas Parsons, who to most people in the country was known to be the host of Sail of the Century or that other show that's on the radio that he hosted for many, many years, right almost up until his passing away. He plays, I mean, for start off, he's acting, and no one knew him as an actor really in the 80s. He plays the Reverend Wainwright, and he's absolutely marvelous. Just a Minute is the show that I couldn't get in my head.
Just a
But
minute, yeah.
yeah, but he's absolutely marvelous
Well,
as an
he had a
actor.
history of acting, wasn't he? He
Yes, he
was an
did.
actor before he ended up being,
Being
yeah,
Nicholas
no,
Parsons.
and he's great. I mean, it's a great story as well. And again, it's a reminder, isn't it? By that point, as we were saying, every episode would have tend to have some form of celebrity, and if it didn't, it would probably have a celebrity creature like the Daleks. But yeah, Nicholas Parsons was great. I loved him in that. I mean. It's a shame that the character gets killed off in a weird way because he's such a sympathetic and interesting character. And they gave him, I think he that was an example of where they managed to they cast someone who could really take away from the celebrityism and bring something into the show itself. So it wasn't the sort of the fact that he was Ken Dodd. It was almost like hoping that you would forget he was Nicholas Parsons. But yeah, I mean, he was great, great.
I'm just minded. I'm looking at our notes for this, and because we do a tiny bit of preparation, and there's a name
You
on
do.
there that's standing out to me at the moment, and we'll come to that later because I've just remembered Joan Sim in the Ravelox story,
Oh,
Mysterious Planet.
yes, Mysterious Planet, yeah.
I'd completely forgotten she was in that, and it's I th no that brings me back to something else that crossed in my mind when you mentioned the cleaners in Paradise Towers. There's a kind of, because there's obviously a robot or two types of robots in Mysterious Planet. There's a kind of what I've recently decided, and when I say recently, I mean in probably the last 10 minutes, coined chock-a-block design to robots in Doctor Who in the 80s, isn't there? Do you know
Yes.
what I mean?
I would say, well, maybe Chock-a-Block was, it's the other way around. But no, yes. Yeah, there was in that sort of period of, yeah. I mean, is there any other story? I mean, obviously, you're thinking Paradise Towers as well. Yeah, I suppose there was. But then, suppose you couldn't you say, like, the Crotons were a Chock-a-Block and.
Well, I couldn't deny it, could I? I suppose. But there's obviously the very
Yeah,
similar lines of design in that, isn't there? But it just it in I suppose in black and white, you can maybe get away with it a bit more than you can in colour, though. Because it does feel like there is a kind of a childishness to it. And, that, you know, I'm not saying that that's wrong, because it's a family slash children's TV show, and maybe that is something that's more appealing to a child's eyes. I would personally disagree with that, having been a child in those days. I liked robots that looked like robots rather than robots that look like something I might be able to build.
I think what it was, a lot of it, and why you can sort of see the cleaners as almost being an illegitimate child of the war machines. There's only so many ways that you can, on the cheap, build a monster, and you're constantly trying to find variations, many variations on a theme.
Yeah.
And you've not got much money. You often don't have much space, which is where the cleaners was a bad move, as was the war machines, as was the mechanoids. You know, so you've got certain size restrictions. You've got money restrictions, and you don't want them all, as was obviously with the Daleks, you don't want them all to be walking around. You want something which can look and move differently. So you end up, I suppose, in the end, just trying absolutely everything you possibly can on that small budget. And that is very limiting, I guess. And I think also you've got the limiting factor of how scary can you make it? And as I'm sure you remember, you know, the original development models they had for the for Fenric, for the Hemivores, were far more scary than what you got. Because again, there was a, if I remember rightly, I'm sure Cartmell said there was a veto on those from Nathan Turner because they were too frightening.
Yeah.
So they ended up with the sort of blue creatures, which weren't dissimilar in some looks to what they'd already used in Battlefield for the demon in that, the sort of kind of blue rubberiness. I think that's, you know, kind of a shame as well. So you've got so many limitations on how you can do it. Can't be too scary, can't be too expensive, can't be too big. You know, it's must be difficult to a point where you end up occasionally creating trash. But one in the Mysterious Planet wasn't that bad, was he? I mean, you know, he was tall. That sort of gave a bit of a power to him.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I know what you mean. There was that sort of modular limb. Everything felt,
And you can definitely tell that there's someone inside as well. That's the other thing about those types of robots. Which, obviously, there is someone inside, but it's convincing the audience that there isn't someone inside, which is...
Well, it's always the audience part for when they would see something like that, to be looking for the grill for the actor to be looking out of, if it was taller than the actors. Like, where's the eye bit? I mean, Marvin the Paranoid Android is pure chock-a-block, and...
Yeah.
He's great, but he is a comedy character for it.
Before we move on to...
And
the,
I suggest anyone... should we just say, if you don't know what Chock-a-Block is, you need to go to YouTube and that will show you what Chock-a-Block is.
Yes, absolutely. You totally should. And say hello to Brian for us. Now, before we move Before 2005... Before we move on to 2005, there is something that we need to do. And I need to move away from the microphone for this bit. When I say something that we mean to do, what I mean is an actor we need to mention. Ryan Blessed! Is, of course, in Mind Warp, isn't he? And I mean, surely that is the biggest kind of... Isn't that the biggest guest casting celebrity, you know, stunt casting thing for Doctor Who in the 80s? Isn't it Brian Blessed? If not actually the biggest, and certainly in terms of how big the person is.
I'm just picturing you screaming that with Brian Blessed just going by in his car, and just like, what would he be thinking at that moment?
He'd probably wind down the window and tell me you F off.
Yes, he probably would.
Which is fine. Brian Blessed plays King Akarnos in Mind Warp. And he is, I mean, this is post Flash Gordon, isn't it? And whilst already established as an actor of standard TV dramas, Shakespearean dramas, the classical I, Claudius and things like that, he's also in a kind of his career is kind of also developing into Brian Blessed, the personality.
Oh yes,
isn't it, at that point? So he's turning up with Brian Blessed all over the place, shouting Gordon's alive at people and things. And on just a quick aside to that, and because we talked about Flash Gordon many years ago on the Beyondcast Service podcast, and we also talked about Thor Ragnarok. Now, I saw Thor Ragnarok 2, as it isn't called, Love and Thunder.
Love and Thunder?
Yeah, I watched Thor Love and Thunder. I did not enjoy it. I found it... I went into it thinking, this isn't going to be as good as Ragnarok, so I've got to measure my expectations. But I found out that I didn't feel it was even unbalanced. I didn't think it was as good as The Dark World. And the best thing about it, conversely, was Natalie Portman, I thought, and the rest of it. And the Screaming Goats, I suppose. But most of the rest of the film, I really didn't enjoy at all. I didn't enjoy it. I was not impressed.
I enjoyed it. I mean, it didn't have the sheen and flow of Ragnarok by any means, but I enjoyed the performances. Yeah, the Screaming Goats were obviously a highlight.
And Russell Crowe as well. Russell Crowe was marvellous.
Russell Crowe was very good. I loved his awkward, uncomfortable relationship with his hammer and axe. There was some great shots in there with that. I don't know. There was just a lot of fun in it. I think, as you say, it pales against Ragnarok, because Ragnarok is just such a solid film from start to finish. And I think the problem with Love and Thunder.
There's one to talk about.
Love and Thunder, and with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. I think both of them, I think, struggle from the COVID period. I think there's a lot of... a lot of concerns, a lot of issues, I think a lot of practical issues. I think there's probably a lot of creative issues going through those periods. And some of the outtakes that they've started showing from Love and Thunder don't even fit into the show, yeah, into the film, which kind of makes me think there was a lot of rewrites, which there were for Multiverse of Madness, as well as a director change. So I kind of feel, to be fair to Marvel, I think some of the stuff that's come out post-COVID that was in production or in during COVID has struggled in its output. And they are both messy films.
There's maybe a different podcast for us here entirely to expand on this, but I do wonder whether actually the problem isn't COVID and lockdowns and all those restrictions. I do actually wonder whether the problem is actually the TV shows are changing expectations of Marvel movies. But we will come back to that another time. Brian Blessed was in Mind Warp, which Mind Warp's a strange show because it's got the Doctor doesn't win, basically, and which is very rare in the 80s. And it's got an overall very good cast, and then you've got the interjections with Michael Jason as Valiad and Linda Bellingham with the Inquisitor, which a lot of people found a little bit jarring at the time, which makes the entire 12-episode series very kind of unique, isn't it? It is an unusual run of episodes. You either like it or
it's unique and it's stupid, and it's easy to say retrospectively, I suppose, and I can get away with it since most people have moved on, but it is a unique, you know, the show struggling the season before, and it's weird, the 80s is filled with this, where rather than actually find what's wrong with the show and repair it, they go and add or change it. And it almost like they don't know what to do. They can't see the problem. So they just roll the dice and hope that it will land on something better.
Yeah.
And you see this across the board, particularly in the States. You can see it in a lot of the Glenn Larson productions. You can see it in Knight Rider.
Oh, yes.
You can see it in the A-Team. You can see it. It happens a lot where they'll just, rather than repair or try and tighten what they've got, they will just try and take it into a different direction, hope that just gains people's interest. And the Trial of the Time Lord doing the 12 episodes all interlinked on a show which is already in problems as it is. There's already tensions between its writing and producing, and that is a big logistical thing to do. It's just a bad idea. And it was a shame because Colin Baker's so much better in it. He's, you know, his character is so much more enjoyable to watch.
He is.
Him and Nicola are working so much better in the two stories that they're both in. And even, you know, Bonnie Langford's not bad, really, to me anyway. She's bearable in, I'm sorry, she's far better in Big Finish, but, you know, the character not been given, as we've said before, an origin or anywhere for the audience to really get to grips with her as a character, end up just seeing Bonnie Langford, who was popular as Bonnie Langford at the time, maybe the ultimate guest star in terms of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. She's actually a companion.
And she's a companion, and she doesn't have any origin. So like a guest star, she's just dropped in, you know, apart from three lines.
In fact, you know, I mean, the whole sort of her being some sort of computer expert is obviously nonsense and it doesn't suit you at all. It's, I mean, you know, in retrospect, there's maybe an excuse for actually just casting Bonnie Langford as Bonnie Langford, who's accidentally found herself traveling through time and space with a man who looks like another actor.
Yeah. And it feels like that as well. I mean, she's... she struggles largely because of that, because they don't give her any foundation. So the audience, I think, just see Bonnie Langford. Now, if they'd done it with an unknown in that, they could have got away with it, I think. I think the character would have perhaps seemed less jarring if it was an unknown person. But because it's Bonnie Langford, because it's someone the audience know or they see, because it's not even the attempt at giving the character of Mel any foundations or anything beyond the image of Bonnie Langford, unlike, say, Nicholas Parsons' character, she just drifts and floats as almost like the ultimate guest star.
Okay.
Which sucks.
Yeah.
Which is why I think she works well in... Oh, well, we're going to that, are we? Fine.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
It doesn't matter. I've been usurped by the stupid sound effect.
I wanted to move us on to 2005 and onwards.
You wanted to prove that we weren't scripted. Carry on. I've already done that. I've already done that, Christian. They know we're not scripted.
Do we have to prove that?
Yeah, I'm sure we do. I'm sure this one out there. I'm pretty sure this is scripted.
Yeah, I mean,
they might think we're Taskmaster.
Yeah, I was going to say we're not Taskmaster. Anyway, yeah. So 2005, Doctor Who. There's a new show. It comes along for the first time in sort of 9 years. It hasn't been on since before. I mean, I suppose it's something to say for... Is there anything to say about the TV movie, really? I don't think... Eric Roberts wasn't hugely known in the UK. Daphne Ashbrook wasn't hugely known in the UK, unless you watch US soap. So I don't suppose there is an awful lot, is there?
No, not really.
No. No, we can skip that. 2005, Doctor Who came back with Christopher Eccleston as the Doctor. Not, as I discovered, an old newspaper cutting the other day from the same day that Christopher Eccleston was announced, not Bill Nye. Do you remember that? One of the papers, I think it was the Mail or the Express, was absolutely convinced that Bill Nye was the Doctor.
No, I don't. I remember. I don't remember following it and then seeing in a W.H. Smith, because I used to go into shops at the time.
Yeah.
And there was a mag. I think it might have been Doctor Who magazine or something, which had Christopher Eccleston on the cover. I think that's how I found out.
All right. I was on holiday in... We went to Austria, and there was a day at the Munich Beer Festival. It was the first time Kerry and I went away together. Got home, and, you know, I'd been in contact with my parents whilst on holiday and things. And they didn't mention, knowing that I'm a Doctor Who fan, they didn't mention that Doctor Who was back. So I got home and I saw the same edition of Doctor Who magazine. And I was like, what the heck's been going on? It's like I'd come back to a parallel universe. It was crazy. What's that all about? No, still don't get that.
It's funny when things like that just drop. It's just like, okay, that's changed my reality in a weird way.
And I suppose Rose Tyler, Billy Piper was guest casting, really. Stunt casting, really.
Yeah, there was. And I think there was there's that interesting question, isn't it? Between, as you say, guest casting and stunt casting. And, you know, what way is the separation? But it did feel a bit like that. And I remember maybe on the back of as you say, what we're talking about, the stunt casting of the 80s, that's what this felt like.
Yes. Yes, it did.
And I suppose that's our definition, you know, because you can guest cast, say, for someone who fits the role, and the stunt cast is kind of a role that's been made to fit the personality.
Okay, yeah.
Perhaps is a very broad definition, just trying to think where we'd go with the different. I don't think it's an exact science because, you know, like Nicholas Parsons really worked in that and it fitted the character, but there's no doubt they were probably looking for Nicholas Parsons to play that character because they wanted Nicholas Parsons. So I don't know. Like I say, we don't plan these things.
No, we don't. I suppose...
But she was. But she was really good.
She was really, really good.
As an actress.
Yeah, she was. I mean, she'd already been doing a few things as in acting before Doctor Who, two or three things she'd appeared in. But Doctor Who was the first thing that gave Billy Piper like the big, this is, you know, she can act, sort of. She's not just a pop star who sings songs you remember from the late 90s. She can act. And by the end of Rose, it wasn't so much... That's Billy Piper, it's the singer. It's more like Billy Piper's, you know, the co-star of Doctor Who. It worked perfectly. I'm just skipping through the series because there's obviously something that happens the following year. I'm just double-checking there isn't anything in that series that I've missed.
What about Barrowman? Because, I mean, Barrowman was...
Well, no, you're right, yes.
Was known, but he wasn't really known. He would do feel like stunt casting.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that's what I mean. He was more known for his,
being John Barrowman. Yes. No, yeah. You're right. You are. You're right. He was John Barrowman. He was John Barrowman, the TV presenter. John Barrowman, the TV host, the co-host of Live and Kicking, and appearing on a few other things, and his own little showbiz show and what have you. And yeah, no, you're absolutely right. John Barrowman. I'd forgotten about that.
So, I mean, again... It's interesting how if we go to 2005, you can see Davis, who is a producer. I've always said he's producer before writer. And I don't mean that to not acknowledge his good writing, but, you know, he went into the industry as a producer, playing very producer tactics, kind of borrowed from the understanding of Nathan Turner, but almost amping them. So he's not just producing them into guest star roles. He's actually, well, no, I suppose Nathan Turner did it with, as we said, with Bonnie Langford. So maybe can't even take that away from Nathan Turner. He was the first to almost stunt cast with the actual companions.
Yeah.
But Davis unashamedly going, well, yeah, if I'm going to get someone big name for this, I want them for a few episodes, you know, let's play with this.
Yeah, it definitely worked. And later in the series, you've got Simon Pegg in The Long Game.
Yeah.
And you've got John Barrowman turns up in Empty Child and Doctor Dances. In Boomtown, you've got Annette Badland, to people of a certain age and a bit younger than me, Annette Badland was kind of a well-known for appearing in a particular TV show, the name of which escapes me right now, that my sister used to watch. Happy Families, that was it, in based on the card game Happy Families. And right. I mean, obviously she's been in tons of stuff, and currently the only reason, she's the main reason to watch Midsummer Murders, because her character in Midsummer Murders is absolutely perfect. Just absolutely what you want from a show like that. Comic relief without actually being comic relief. So dry. Excellent character. You've got Annette Badland, who isn't really stunt casting, I suppose, but she's... a thing called hook casting, which... that kind of sort of being a familiar
hooks
face.
You in, but is someone yes. who is... Because in the end, there is an argument that, yeah, you could go with an unknown, but if you go with someone who's got a lot of professional experience within making certain types of television, you know that you're going to get the performance you want. So that is less a stunt, it's more of a hook.
Yeah.
Well, someone like Bonnie Langford is a bit more of a stunt than a hook, because she doesn't have that experience. I suppose John Barrowman might be as well, maybe. I don't know. I suppose it depends on the audition, doesn't it? It depends on whether they were how you went for them. Did you go solely for them, or did they audition and they were just really good and that was why you went for them, and that was a name that you could then... It's all so complicated.
It is a bit. Well, yeah, by the end of the series, you've got Anne Robinson, Trini Woodall, Susanna Constantine and Davina McCall all appearing in the same episode. Yeah. But only their voices.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is that kind of... I mean, I talked about Brian Blessed being sort of like the ultimate of this. Well, maybe that is the actual... Maybe this is some sort of kind of singularity of stunt casting in Doctor Who.
To be fair with Bad Wolf, I wonder how much of that is stunt casting and how much of it is about cementing the satire of the story. Because I don't recall, outside of Confidential, there being much noise about Davina McCall. And I didn't actually realise it was Anne Robinson until the credits. I wasn't totally sure, because I didn't believe they'd have got all these people. I just thought they'd got impersonators. So in there, you've got another type of casting where they are not so much stunt. They are there to actually make the actual satire believable and to give that character and integrity and a sort of honesty to it. So that was kind of interesting. So I think they underplayed that. They didn't really promote it in the same way as you say they would have. They promoted Simon Pegg, who was, said to be in the series. So I think there's these little differentiations of this sort of casting issue, which I never thought we would come up with in this conversation.
No, I didn't either. No,
because it's not scripted.
Well, the following
and
year.
To be fair,
go on.
To be fair, with Taskmaster, a lot of the bits which seem scripted are not. The bits at the beginning with Alex Horn does with Greg Davis, who is also another guest star in Doctor Who. Alex knows what he's going to say, but Greg doesn't. So there is a certain amount of improv even in those bits. But I digress. Moving on.
All right. We've got a school reunion with Anthony Head.
Anthony Head, yep.
Yeah.
Meant to be a really, really nice guy, according to Mum's Net.
Oh, good. Prior to that, Tooth and Claw with, my God, Pauline Collins as Queen Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got...
I've never watched that episode more than once.
Well, there you go. You've got the Sidemen stuff going on and what have you. And there isn't really any massive casting in Doctor Who, I don't really think, at that point. Until you hit episode 10, Love and Monsters. And suddenly, you got Peter Kay.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I mean, this is Ken Dodd levels of casting, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. I mean, again, I have a soft spot for that story. And I think he's very funny in it as well. And he plays the bits well, but it is a role for Peter Kay.
It is a role for Peter Kay. Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. I mean, it's a funny old story because, the entire format of the story is very un-Doctor Who. Then you've got this idea of this kid who wins the competition on Blue Peter to create a monster, which is... according to his designs, bigger than a bus, and they cast Peter Kay, who's not bigger than a bus. And there was a story at the time that the kid who won the competition was a bit disappointed with the actual size of the Absorbloff, but I'm sure he must have got over it by now, so we shouldn't worry too much for him. And then we move on, and then we get to the one which I think is the heart of my idea for this podcast, Barbara Windsor in Army of Ghosts. And
an EastEnders clip.
Yes, when they're watching EastEnders, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Which is funny because she's not actually in Doctor Who, is she? She's in a special clip of EastEnders that didn't actually happen, but in Doctor Who. So she's not interacting with any of the characters in Doctor Who beyond her life as a TV being in Doctor Who. But she's in Doctor Who, and she's Barbara Windsor playing Peggy Mitchell in Doctor Peggy. Who. Yeah. So there's a few levels of reality being played with there, isn't it?
But again, isn't that similar to the Bad Wolf, isn't it? Because
I
don't remember it being massively promoted, but it's kind of in there to sort of authenticate their world almost. And Davis was always very keen on as we saw many times, which is something that Nathan Turner never really did, in trying to root Doctor Who into our world. You know, the BBC news clips would always have, and Moffat carried this on as well, obviously. And so Chibnall as well, I think, you know, have relevant personalities that we know of the news as doing news, to try and create that authenticity of their reality as being ours. And, you know, EastEnders being that way, which of course was much distress to fans, having watched Dimensions in Time and knowing that had a production code, and creating much confusion in their mind, because, you know, it's a TV show and also part of their continuity. What's going on there?
Yeah, good point. Can we pause for a few minutes?
Yep.
I just need to go and do something. I will be back shortly.
Really? I need the actual sting so I know to pause? Well, this is an awkward space. I wonder if he stopped recording. I'm going to assume he hasn't. He's just, oh, I don't know, he might have. This could be a waste of time. I could tell you all about Taskmaster if he's recording. If he's not recording, no one will ever hear this outside of my room. No, I think he was pretty unfair to Taskmaster. I mean, I say initially I was a little unsure, but there's a certain sort of freshness to the actual format, which has kept me watching. That sort of mixture of structure and improvisation is, you know, it makes exciting live television. Well, it's not live, but you get my point.
Hello, sorry about that.
It's okay.
Right, hold on, I'll just do that sound effect again, then I can just cut this out. So let's move on. The following series, you've got some interesting casting, mainly John Sim and... How can I possibly forget the name Derek Jacobi? But there you go. But you've also got the silly casting, like Sharon Osbourne, or the guest casting, the celebrity appearances, I guess we're calling them, really. Sharon Osbourne and Anne Widdecombe, which they're not really casting, are they? They're celebrity appearances. What am I talking about? That's what they are. So it's almost like there's like a formula developing, isn't it, of kind of well-known people. You've also got Thelma Barlow, who's well-known from... Coronation Street, and Michelle Collins from EastEnders appearing in the show at that point. So you've got this kind of well-known people to know. And then you've got the celebrities like Anne Widdecombe and Sharon Osbourne and McFly turning up. And there's almost a formula to it developing, isn't there, where you've got these big name casting, famous names are going to appear for like one episode, that the hook casting or whatever you want to call them, and then you've got the celebrity appearance where it's starting to resemble, you likened it to Noel's House Party. There's also equally, I suppose, the old Markham and Wise shows as well, or any of those sort of variety comedy shows where you'd have like the as you alluded to earlier on, the famous face turning up. And that happening throughout the Russell T Davies era, really. I think it gets carried on into Moffat's era as well, in some shape or form. So I suppose that there is a lot of this, of people turning up, and some of it's good and some of it's bad. And you've got the Frank Skinner one with the Capaldi. I quite like the Frank Skinner one, actually. I think Frank Skinner is surprisingly good, actually. Yeah. He, which season? Is that 10? I'm thinking it's 10.
Yeah, I think it's 10.
So I don't think he's the only one. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, you've got Ralph Little and David Suchet as well. And obviously you've got, I suppose maybe you've got the second instance. Well, I suppose Catherine Tate's the second instance of companion stunt casting, isn't she? I was going to say Matt Lucas, but I suppose Catherine Tate is probably the one that we've overlooked considerably and probably shouldn't have, because she was Catherine Tate. She was massive for being Catherine Tate.
Yes. I wasn't going to overlook it, and then we obviously got distracted. Yeah, I agree. I think that's a big one, which he talks a lot about in his writer's tale book. But I was surprised by that. I was surprised in the series. I never thought, I wasn't actually thrilled with her in Runaway Bride.
No.
I think they played a lot to her famous abrasiveness as a character actor. And they found there was far more to play with. I suppose at the back end, you start seeing some of that in Runaway Bride, but you certainly see it through the following series where they bring her back and it's, incredibly good. But yeah, there's
Well,
no doubt. And yeah.
yeah, I was going to say it's the Matt Lucas thing, I suppose, also is a little different because there's kind of the comedy career of Matt Lucas, and that kind of stopped, didn't it? And hasn't really picked up again. And then he's appears in Doctor Who, so that's maybe a little different. But I think Catherine Tate in, yeah, go on.
Yeah, no, well, I'm just thinking about it because I think there's a. I suppose there was a weird oddity that happens in post 2005 where she's, originally going back, as we were saying with the original show, companions were kind of fairly fresh names. They tended to be younger people, so they didn't have that much of a career to draw on and beforehand anyway, with maybe the exception of Bonnie Langford that springs to my brain. I could be wrong. But you get into 2000, post 2005, and companions have been drawn in to some degree as names because those names will get. And maybe some of that's due, maybe there's a change in the way newspapers are working, in the
Yeah.
fact that you need more than just a guest star in one single episode to get that interest. And you're also trying to obviously tap into the internet and maybe a little into fandoms as well. And maybe, I don't know, maybe fandoms are not one you, I don't know. But I'd be interested to hear from people like Moffat and Davis on that. Because you get a lot of negative reaction from this sort of stuff. You get negative reaction from fandoms with Piper, Barrowman, I suppose, as well. Maybe I don't remember with Barrowman, but certainly with Catherine Tate. But you are drawing, because their names, and like Matt Lucas as well as a regular. You're getting people in that will get those headlines because they're in more than just one episode. They are now going to be the companion, and that has a bigger cachet. So there's a shift there in the strategy. I think you're right.
And then you got moving on, you got Bradley Walsh, and then you've got John Bishop in the more recent Chris Chibnall era episodes. And you've got a few people turning up, but I suppose on the whole, Stephen Fry and Lenny Henry aside, they're not massive names, but they are all very, I mean, the quality of the acting that they brought in the majority of the Chibnall episodes, I think, of the guest cast have all been excellent. So there's less of a stunt casting thing beyond, if we're going to call it that still at this stage, beyond the companion. So, yeah, it's interesting how
Well,
he's developed
I wonder
away
if a
from
little
that.
bit, I
Go on.
wonder if a little bit of that is because people watching it, they're not interested in the stunt cast where you're looking to see Hale and Pace being a bit Hale and Pacey in the show or Ken Dodd being a bit Ken Doddy in the show. They're kind of expecting that whatever is potentially, we'll give it the name stunt casting again, is going to actually integrate, and they'll be almost assessing the show's quality on the basis of how much that name integrates into the show rather than the show playing off with that name. So when Lenny Henry appears, for instance, you're not expecting a wacky Lenny Henry character. In fact, you'd be offended if that was the case. While in the 80s, perhaps you would expect the Lenny Henry package. You know, that the that reputation, that identity to be being used as an ingredient in the context of the show, as with Ken Dodd. I know keep pushing Ken Dodd, but even to some degree Beryl Reed, who always had quite a sort of had a bit of a tough line, not as tough as her captain, but was always a bit of a tough character. Brian Blessed, obviously.
And of course, we
And to
forgot
see
John
Lenny Henry
Cleese,
play
didn't
a
we?
character is what you're looking for. John Cleese. I mean, John Cleese, yeah, I mean that was pure stunt. And unashamedly as well, and they did that properly. But yeah, so maybe they're looking to see that integration more by this point. You want to see, and if you're using companion, you need them to integrate, which is perhaps again another different category in itself. The companion must integrate, cannot exist on their identity. They need to be transformative, and the success of the show is how transformative they are. and Piper was the first one to do that. As you say, Barrowman was a little more large than life, I guess, as his persona. Perhaps he's the one who is perhaps a little bit of it. Well, I suppose Catherine Tate's persona was kind of that character, but she still had to make it part of the show. They still had to make it feel part of the show. And I think that comes down to Davis's writing.
Yeah, yeah.
That he writes someone who's very grounded and believable as a temp.
Yeah, which works.
And also, we've missed big one there, haven't we? We talk about Tate, Cribbins.
Oh, good Lord.
Again, not saying he's stunt casting, but he's guest casting with the name attached.
Yeah.
And he, in a sense, helps work in grounding Tate. I think Tate works better in the series than in the Runaway Bride, because you've got people like Cribbins there to help give that authenticity to that character as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Definitely. Which I suppose Catherine Tate and Bernard Cribbins, and also the fact that I've already mentioned Bradley Walsh and John Bishop, brings us right up to date. We are recording this prior to the arrival of The Power of the Doctor, the recently named final episode for the Jodie Whittaker incarnation of Doctor Who. And we know that that has some interesting casting in the shape of Janet Fielding and Sophie Aldred, which, I mean, where does that come in our kind of, I suppose, with developing this spectrum of casting for Doctor? Where does that come?
Yeah,
is that stunt casting? Is it guest casting? Is it kind of nostalgia casting? What is that?
It's either nostalgia or diegetic kind of guest casting, because, you know, your guest isn't Sophie Aldred. Your guest is Ace, isn't it? Your guest is not the actor per se, it's the character, and the actor is the delivery of the character. So in a sense, yes, it's like a nostalgia casting, or as I say, a diegetic casting. You're guest casting from the world's fiction. It's another category.
We need some sort of infographic for this, I feel. We don't know how that's going to turn out. We know very little about the episode. That could be basically the tip of the iceberg of casting.
I'm sure some people listening to this will go, actually, Christian, we need a Venn diagram with these different bubbles all interlinking in the middle with a middle one, which is just like, who cares? Okay, I get that point. Yeah, guest casting, nostalgia casting, stunt casting, hook casting, who cares? I care. I care a lot about it, mate. This has been quite interesting for me.
It has, yeah. It's been a good chat. If you have any thoughts on any of this casting, and if you think we've missed some kind of key elements of casting and promotional casting, guest casting, nostalgia casting, stunt casting, any of that stuff, do let us know. Until that happens, it's bye from us. We will be along with a new show soon. Until then, off you pop.